Hi, everyone, and welcome to Dr. Dark After Dark, number 33, Discussions with Eric Basmajian. I think I got that right. And Eric is the founder of EPB Macro Research, and he's also head of research at Pavali Global, where he works with Teddy Vallet, who a lot of people will have seen on Real Vision and other places. So Eric is known for not just having lots of charts, but also insights on the charts. And I think too many people on Twitter just post charts, but they're not thinking about what does it mean and why. And I think Eric is brilliant with that stuff. So as always, this isn't investment advice. Please do your own research. Eric, welcome. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me on. Doing very well.
Absolutely. Well, let's get stuck in. So, okay, well, why don't we dive into what is perhaps the most important question in macro? Of course, that's arguable, which is the whole debate on inflation versus deflation. You've written a lot about this recently, and it's obviously a hot topic. Maybe we focus on the US, else it just gets too complex. You know, what are your thoughts? And then let's see where it goes.
Sure. So when thinking about inflation, I think one of the most important things to get at the front of the conversation is what is the metric that we're all looking at? We have to sort of have a standardized measure, because your personal rate of inflation is probably quite different than my personal rate of inflation, which is certainly different than my parents' rate of inflation, who may be retired and things like that. So generally, we'd be looking at anything like the CPI, the PCE, because that's what influences the bond market the most. The bond market, the treasury market's the benchmark for basically all interest rates. So if we look over the last 20, 30 years, we've seen a steady decline in the rate of inflation measured by the CPI, the PCE. That's been weighing on bond yields, pushing them lower and lower. And right now, with all of the new extravagant Fed policies, fiscal stimulus, everyone's trying to figure out, are we going to continue the same trend? Are we going to have lower and lower rates of inflation like we've had for the last 20, 30 years? Or are we finally going to have a regime change? Is the CPI really going to go to 2, 3, 4% on a sustained basis and take bond yields higher with it? I've recently written about there's primarily three paths forward, given the current situation that we're in, which I'm sure we'll dive into. Two of the paths, I think we continue on the same route, which is a lower inflation. There's one option where the Federal Reserve Act gets changed, or they either start to act around the Federal Reserve Act and start printing money more directly, because the current quantitative easing procedures are not exactly printing money and are not inflationary. So generally, my thoughts are that we're probably going to continue to have lower and lower rates of inflation, when I think the consensus is starting to fear inflation more and more. I'm not totally in that camp yet, for reasons we can probably get into.
Right. And I think it's interesting, because I think the consensus a month or two ago was very much in that camp. But I've started to see a few smart people on FinTwit who are, I mean, there are people who have always been in the camp of, look, it's the Dr. Lacey Hunt argument, right? That it's deflationary, and then I don't need to have more of an argument. But we've clearly had, you know, whilst there were 3 months of negative CPI a few months ago, you know, we've had some relatively positive month on month since then. Although in the grand scheme of things, you know, year on year, things are not exactly, you know, inflating at a massive rate. I'm starting to see more people, and it's certainly not consensus, I think, being a little more, pausing for a bit and thinking, well, wait a minute, there's some number of unemployed, whether it's 30 million or whatever the number is, we can argue all day, but it's a really, really big number. And, you know, Q4, you know, for example, Hedgeye are now basically saying 50-50 that Q4 will go into what they call Q4, which would be deflationary or disinflationary, versus Q3, which would be more inflationary. So I'm not sure what's kind of changed that, whether it's anything to do with the election or just, you know, just the fact that the recovery is, yes, that there's been some good recovery, but equally it's going to take a long, long, long time to get back to where we were in, say, December 19.
Exactly. And I'll probably jump in here with a couple of comments, something that I've been thinking through and writing about. So the current situation is very interesting as it pertains to inflation, because we have short-term trends and then we have the longer trend. And Dr. Lacey Hunt, who I know you've spoken to, is very much in the long-term trend. He's in the 3 to 5 year camp is where he would look. But we have trends over the next 6 months and 8 months, which could be quite different, which he probably looks at a little bit less. So what happened was we had a major deflationary shock. A lot of countries were locked down and supply chains were totally disrupted. And to this day, supply chains aren't fully back to where they were. But what was also interesting is that there was a huge shift in consumption. And what I mean by that is everybody was locked inside their home, so they couldn't consume services for the most part, restaurants, any type of entertaining, sports games, all of that type of consumption fell dramatically. And what consumers ended up doing, which we can see in the consumption data, is they shifted their consumption. They forewent any consumption in services, and they shifted that consumption to things at home, more durable goods. You know, a hypothetical example would say, well, if we can't go out to eat, let's buy a new grill. And when we start to see this happen at scale, what ended up happening is we ended up depleting a lot of inventory of durable goods, which restarted a restocking process. Everyone that held durable goods had to restock their whole inventory. Well, that kind of jumpstarts an industrial manufacturing process around the whole world, because the durable goods that we consume are almost exclusively produced elsewhere. So we started this restocking industrial process at a time when commodity supply chains were slightly disrupted. You know, some copper mills were shut down, there were some lumber issues, and we see the prices of these commodities surging. Now, some of that's organic, because there is a legitimate demand increase from this restocking process, but the price increase of some of these commodities was probably more dramatic than it otherwise would have been, because there's so many supply chain disruptions. That's giving the inflation camp some fuel to say, hey, look, these commodity prices are really off the charts. And it's true. If we counterbalance that with what maybe Dr. Lacey Hunt would say, is that, you know, there's a pent-up demand recovery in the economy. We all could have expected something like that once we all moved out of lockdown. Once these supply chains normalize and consumption goes back to a more similar blend of what it was, we're still going to have the same excess capacity issues that we've had for the last 20 or 30 years. So this inflation that we're seeing now in some areas, we're seeing, you know, outright deflation in other areas like commercial real estate, but the inflation that we are seeing has a lot to do with a radical shift in consumption, a radical shift in consumer behavior, along with disrupted supply chain, which is causing a little bit more increase in price than we would normally see.
So does that mean, that's really interesting. So if we focus on durable goods and inventories, so what data are you using to track that? I mean, the US puts data out every month. It does include inventories, I think, from memory on.
There's a lot of different places where you can get inventory data. So, you know, in the durable goods report that comes out, they publish durable goods, core capital goods. There's also measures of inventory in there. In the ISM report, there's measures of inventory. And one of the great measures in the ISM report, one of the more leading indicators actually, is the book to bill ratio, or the new orders to inventory ratio. And we've seen that move up pretty considerably, indicating that inventories have gone down, new orders have gone up. The reason it's a leading indicator is because if you have no inventory but a lot of new orders, you got to refill that inventory. So we're seeing that for sure. But given the long-term trends in the economy, it's unclear that this process that we've started is going to carry us through for the next 3, 4, 5 years, and we're off to the races and everything's going to be great. As you mentioned, there's still a tremendous amount of unemployment. I was looking at the numbers recently. There's actually, we're still missing 11.5 million jobs from the peak in February of 2020. So we're still down about 11.5 million. In the depth of 2008, we were down about eight and a half million. So even inclusive of the big recovery in jobs that we've had, we're still worse off in terms of the labor gap than we were at the depths of the 2008 recession. So, you know, while we definitely have this pent-up demand recovery going on, we've definitely jump-started an industrial process around the world. When this fades, when inventories do get restocked, you know, what are we going to do with the high levels of unemployment? What are we doing with fiscal support? All of that comes back into play. And this sort of, you know, pent-up demand rebound, inflationary rebound is probably going to start to fizzle out.
Right. And how are you measuring? So, I mean, unemployment's another hot potato, right? So, you know, we could look at U3, U6. So for those listening, you know, U3 is basically people who have been looking for a job for the last 30 days. And if you've been looking for a job for 31 days, you're not counted. And U6 is in effect the same, but for a year, roughly. There's a few other subtle differences. But then also, if I look at things like the pandemic unemployment assistance, so the PUA, I think that's still running. I mean, it's running at a super big number still. If you look at continuous jobless claims, continuing jobless claims, you get to a number far higher than, I think, kind of 11.5 million. Is this just
so the 11.5 million? Yeah, the 11.5 million number comes from the total number of non-farm payrolls. So, you know, off the top of my head, I think we had something like 155 million payrolls before. Now it's, you know, 140 or something, something like that. Yeah. So
okay, that's a pretty good.
That's one way that I look at it. But you're right. I'm not a huge fan of U3 or even U6. What I actually like to look at is the employment to population ratio.
Yeah.
I think that has the most information about the state of the labor market and the economy more generally. So even with this this rebound that we've had in employment, we only see the employment to population ratio at 56 and a half. And that's still the lowest number going back all the way to either the 60s or the 70s. So as a percentage of the population, we're still really, really underemployed.
Yeah. And that's, I agree on that. And that's, I think, Neil Howe from the one in Demographer, that's his favorite measure. He talks about
I think it holds the most information. And you know, I'm a big student of Dr. Jeffrey Moore, founded the economic cycle, ECRI. And in some of his earlier work, he was using the employment to population ratio as an inflation indicator. You know, we look at the, unfortunately, a lot of people still look at the U3 unemployment rate as an indicator of inflation. You know, low employment supposed to signal higher inflation, but, you know, as we know, that doesn't really work.
The Phillips
all that
curve.
Well.
That's been
exactly.
I had that Professor Blanchflower on a few weeks ago, and he, if you get him talking on that, you were there for a few days. So yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly right. So we know that doesn't work all that well, but, you know, the employment to population ratio makes a ton more sense. So we say, oh my God, the labor market's so tight. Why is inflation not picking up? Well, the best we got to was about 61% in before the pandemic happened. But the prior cycle in 2006, 2007, we were at 63, 64%. And in 2000, we were at almost 65%. So, you know, as far as judging slack in the labor market or the inflationary pressure in the labor market, I think the employment to population ratio is a much better gauge than U3. And you could even break it down by age bracket. You know, they have 25 to 54, you know, they have all the different categories.
It's interesting what you said on the at home versus basically going out spend. It's exactly what, so I think it was yesterday's Breakfast with Dave Rosenberg put a lot of charts about this and just showed every single graph of what's happened to CPI of pretty much everything you can ever think of, and everything that was you do at home has gone up, and basically everything that involves going out had pretty much gone down. It was pretty pure and simple.
I mean, when you look at the durable goods component of the personal consumption report, I mean, the durable goods consumption was increasing at 12 or 13% year over year. Just absolutely huge increases that we really haven't seen since the 2000s or maybe even earlier. So just a huge, huge shift. I mean, net consumption, didn't move that much because it was a decline in services in exchange for a rise in durables. But that blend, that shift was incredibly impactful because, you know, going to get a haircut, services consumption doesn't require any inventory or a manufacturing process. But the durable goods consumption, the reason that it's, you know, typically more of a leading indicator is because it has ripple effects through that whole manufacturing process.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Okay, so it sounds like, well, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's like, obviously we had a big deflationary shock. Let's just call it the at-home economy has meant that there's, you know, been a reinvigoration of that type of demand at the expense of basically going out stuff or services. It's hard to tell how long that inventory restocking will go on for, but it's probably wise to keep an eye on that type of data. Because again, what listeners would be looking for is, you know, well, how can I work this out a few weeks before everyone else? So
yeah, right, exactly.
Not always so easy. So how would you, what would be your kind of top tip for that?
Sure. So I have a couple comments on that. I'll start with the negative news first. The negative news is that this is absolutely a much more difficult cycle to monitor than past cycles. So most of my work is focused on building economic indicators and trying to forecast the economic cycle, like you just said. I took courses in econometrics, but I don't optimize production functions or things like that. Most of my work is more similar to Jeffrey Moore, trying to create a leading indicator of various cycles, the manufacturing cycle. And the reason this cycle is so difficult is because normally we can say, let's look at some leading indicators of the manufacturing process, because that's more cyclical than services and that's going to move first. Well, we start to see the growth rate coming down in manufacturing. Is that confirmed by lower hours worked in manufacturing? Yes, it is. That means there's probably going to be layoffs in manufacturing. Layoffs in manufacturing means higher unemployment, which may mean lower consumption. And you can sort of get this predictable sequence that goes on. Typically, it always was focused on the industrial side of the economy because it was just more cyclical, more sensitive to changes in interest rates and demand and things like that. Services consumption, it's just not very volatile because so much of it is non-discretionary. Things like healthcare, things like, food, things like that. And the reason this cycle is so difficult is because you can have good leading indicators of the manufacturing process, let's say, but the government intervention can override all of that. So let's say you have a full upturn right now. Let's say all my indicators of the manufacturing process are still pointing higher, but tomorrow they say we have an outbreak in COVID cases. We got to shut everything down. Well, it doesn't really matter what your leading indicator said at that point because everything is going to fall off the page to the bottom again, just like it did prior. So we have to work within that framework and try our best to stick with the indicators. And you can try and forecast anything that's going on the government side, but social distancing rules and fiscal support are two variables that are much more difficult to predict than the traditional economic cycle sequence, which we know quite well. With all that being said, things that I would look for to spot a fizzling out of this restocking process or this industrial rebound are things like commodity prices. Everybody can track the price of things like lumber, copper, oil. But the CRB, the Commodity Research Bureau, publishes a bunch of commodities that trade less. They're not like copper where they have active futures contracts where anybody with an account can go speculate on the price of copper. They're harder to speculate items, things like rubber, things like copper scrap, lead scrap, wool tops, all components that are very important to the manufacturing process, but are less skewed by investor sentiment and investor speculation. So tracking commodity prices, both those that are exchange traded and those are, that are lesser exchange traded, is important. Tracking various inventory ratios like the ISM report and the book to bill, that's pretty important. I would, you know, as much of a read as you can get on the service sector, I'd be looking at the hours worked in the service sector based on across all the different segments. If you start to see the hours worked in the service sector start to tail off across many different categories, that would be an indication that the recovery in the service sector is not that great. So those are the kind of the main things that I'd be watching, you know, various commodity prices, new orders to inventory ratios, and hours worked in the service sector would kind of be some of the main tips that I would keep on my screen.
That's good stuff. I love it. It's good. And I like the idea of things like copper scrap versus copper, because again, you've always got to try and, you know, futures markets make so many things so easy to speculate in.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm a very big fan of the commodities that are less known, or, you know, copper scrap, like versus copper. I don't think I have any price on this, but for example, you know, like everything that's exchange traded, there's sort of a pair to it that's lesser exchange traded. So like instead of lumber, plywood, and you could sort of, when the two of them are moving in the same direction, it's sort of extra confidence that, okay, there's definitely some real demand going on here. And what we're seeing now is there's absolutely a major rise in both the exchange traded and the non-exchange traded, which makes you quite certain that there's definitely a industrial rebound going on. And like we talked about, it's probably exaggerated by some supply chain disruptions. What's interesting though, is when you see them, the two of them diverge, maybe the copper scrap starts to go down while the price of copper is going up. Well, that may mean that investors are kind of speculating on copper, but the real demand is kind of moving in the other direction. So those are good indicators.
Okay, no, that's good stuff. Okay, so why don't we layer in now the creation of new money? So loans, you know, there's, you know, obviously there was a big spike in M2 money supply at the peak of the crisis, and driven by a lot of companies pulling every revolver they could, i.e. getting access to the cash, because banks could, of course, take that away from them. And of course, there was just general selling of assets from retail and corporate, which meant there was more cash on balance sheets. And there was a big spike in, the big spike in commercial industrial loans was, of course, the revolvers. But since then, really, most of the different loan categories have kind of steadily ticked down. And there are many people that would argue, well, that's clearly not a particularly inflationary thing to be happening. These are companies who are not investing in the future, is that another thing you look at a lot?
Absolutely. I think that you said it perfectly also. In the middle of the crisis, the Fed engaged in pretty large scale QE again, which I think a lot of people interpreted as the QE was causing the surge in money supply. It certainly probably contributed to the rise in money supply, especially if the Fed was sourcing the bonds from non-banks or other financial institutions. There could be a one-time rise in the money supply. But to your point, I think that the rise in the money supply was much more associated with the rise in commercial and industrial loans through the credit revolvers, also through the government-backed PPP loans, and also just a ton of other fiscal stimulus that was coming in terms of one-time checks and unemployment. And also a lot of people stopped repaying old debts. A lot of debts were kind of frozen for a period of time. So all of those factors contributed to a huge surge in money supply. On a 13-week annualized basis, it jumped to almost 80%, which I think was probably the highest we've ever seen. But that rise in money supply was entirely offset, if not more, by a collapse in velocity. Because like you said, everyone drew credit lines and the cash just kind of sat there because everyone was just waiting. Or, businesses got PPP loans, but those PPPs could only be used for payroll or rent or things like that. And a lot of the stimulus that people got was used for basic living needs like food and shelter and stuff. So the velocity of that increase was really low. So the GDP effect was still negative. But to your point, like we've now seen the credit revolver starting to get paid back. The PPP is kind of over for the most part. There's not a whole lot of fiscal support that's supposed to be coming any in the next couple of weeks here. So we've seen the rate of money supply on a 13-week basis go from like plus 80% down to, I think the last time I looked, it was like plus 12. So plus 12 is still a high number, but coming down from plus 80 is dramatic. And that huge drop off is likely due to banks just tightening up their loan books now. And what we're seeing is banks don't really have a huge willingness to lend when there's not a government backing. The PPP was easy because the credit was guaranteed. So sure, you make loans. But when the credit's not guaranteed and banks have to, you know, put their capital at risk, they're not lending. And we see this after every recession. I mean, after the 2008 recession, there was a spike in commercial and industrial loans. I think it was maybe October of 2008, big spike, plus 20% on a 13-week basis. And then it was negative for about a year and a half. So we're seeing the same thing, very, very common pattern after recessions. On top of banks being sort of unwilling to lend, consumers are not that willing to borrow either, at least for business purposes. You know, there's not a whole lot of people that think it's a great time to lever up and build a new factory or anything like that right now. So we're seeing a lower demand on both sides, both from the consumer side. They don't really want to borrow that much. The banks certainly don't want to lend that much, especially when there's no government guarantee. And that's causing a decline in money supply for sure. Now, there is the chance that they reload the PPP program. And if that happens, the banks will surely lend out that money if the consumers want to take it. And they will probably have another rise in the money supply as a result. But that rise is probably going to come with low velocity as well. Because again, high velocity uses of money are you know, plant equipment, new factories, things that, you know, generate a lasting income stream. The PPP funds, if they're restricted to be used for payroll, rent, and utilities, those aren't really high velocity uses. So we'll get another one-time spike, but it'll normalize in time again.
Right. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And one thing that's, I mean, a few thoughts. I spoke to the treasurer of a large regional bank last week and said exactly the same as what you just said. And this is a, you know, multi-tens of billions of dollar balance sheet bank in the US.
Right. Regional banks are my favorite sector.
And this is a regional bank that is well known for making commercial industrial loans. It's their bread and butter. And they're just not having so much demand right now. Now, I mean, anyone that looks at the weekly H8 data can see this. I mean, it's very clear. But it's nice when you also hear, you know, corroborating stories from the coalface. And of course, if we just look at what I'm interested in is the Q3 senior loan officer survey, which I think will come out early November. There's quite a lag on it.
Yep, definitely.
Because the Q2 one was sort of obvious what it was going to say. I mean, right, everyone battens down the hatches and fine. Credit standards through the roof, pretty much to where they were in 08.
Yeah, loan loss provisions start going up, the whole nine.
So I think Q3, Q4 for that's going to be incredibly enlightening. But the one number I don't see so many people talking about, but I'm just kind of thinking it might be one of your early warning signs is those that listen to this know I'm obsessed with the H8 form from the Fed and the consumer loans. One of the sublines is credit cards and other revolving plans. And it's down about $100 billion in the last year from like roughly 850 to 750. So that's outstanding credit cards basically. And right. I, you know, that could be, you know, maybe that is some form of proxy for, services spending where people are going out and, you know, putting stuff on their card a lot. You probably shouldn't be, well, if you're buying a big durable good, I don't know if people are wanting to be putting that type of stuff on credit cards. But interesting, consumer loans overall are basically flat year on year, but the credit card's down quite a lot. So, you know, if I saw that kind of ticking up consistently, that could be another interesting little sign. So
definitely. And I think that was also, I think it was twofold. I think it was definitely less spending on the card. And I think it was also consumers trying to tighten up their balance sheets a little bit. You know, you get extra stimulus money, get extra unemployment. I think a lot of people tried to pay down a lot of credit.
That's sensible. So
totally. Totally.
You're going to be given some money and you're in debt. Pay it off. I mean,
unless you need it
for food and lodging. This,
like, you know, especially as you go, as the consumer expects a more difficult road ahead.
Right. Okay. So still, we could talk forever on inflation, but like,
oh, for sure.
Another interesting thing popped up recently, which, I mean, again, this is when I've been talking for a while. I've been saying to people, well, look, if you like the bond trade, in that if you think we're still in the structural deflationary world, but you're a little concerned that there might be kind of a short-term reflation, little bounce or whatever it might be, then, you know, you could consider TIPS or indeed longer term, well, the longest term maturity TIPS, which there are some ETFs like LTPZ that allows that. And these have done pretty well. It's because the break evens, the inflation expectations embedded in them have been going up. But I've been seeing more and more people recently saying, well, this is just because basically these markets are normally pretty illiquid. And I mean, whilst there's trillions of dollars of TIPS, the amount of flow in those versus nominal bonds is quite small. But now the Fed's buying it all the time, twice a week. There's actually a lot of people have been rotating into these trades that maybe these have just been going up, and basically the liquidity going into that part of the market has in effect made it look like inflation expectations have been going up a bunch, but it's actually just a function of the liquidity. So again, it's this whole cause and effect thing, which I think is really interesting. I mean, another good example is, you know, the real interest rates, negative real interest rates correlate with gold. Well, gold price, yes, but which drives what? You know, you can kind of argue this in different ways. And it may be, by the way, it depends on what's happening, which way you argue it. I'm wondering if you'd looked into any of that stuff. So.
Yeah, definitely. And for sure. We've been spending a lot of time on that. And Teddy, actually, I'm sure you've seen, he recently posted a chart of the Federal Reserve's ownership of the TIPS market, which was about 8% prior to the crisis. And it surged to over 18%.
Well, yeah.
So they bought definitely a significant portion of the TIPS market. I mean, they bought a significant portion of the nominal bond market too, particularly that one stretch in March and April. There does seem to be a liquidity effect that's going on. And what's fascinating is that taking the liquidity effect aside, just looking at the real rate, almost every single trade in the market today, whether it's tech, whether it's gold and metals, whether it's commodities, they all seem to be driven by falling real rates, the decline in the dollar. They're all seemingly the same exact trade. And every time real rates go up, the whole basket unwinds. Tech goes down, the dollar goes up, gold goes down.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. You know, one of the things that Teddy was discussing was, you know, if people come to realize that, hey, actual inflation expectations aren't really going up that much, it's mostly a liquidity move. Is that going to change investor sentiment and say, you know, maybe this decline in real rates, you know, maybe the real rate isn't really -1 or whatever it is. It may be just too much liquidity premium. Is that going to have an effect on some of these asset prices? I think it remains to be seen. I think it remains to be seen how much, what the Fed continues to do with their asset purchases, how they shift the blend, but also, you know, there has been a pretty significant rise in commodity prices as well. So, you know, one thing that I'd be looking for is we have seen these break-even rates sort of start to flatten out as the commodity trade has started to peter out. So we've seen oil go down a little bit, and, you know, it'd be interesting to see if we get a 10-15% decline in commodity prices, do the break-evens respond as they should? Because right now we can say it's a liquidity premium. Mathematically, we can derive that it's a lot of it is the liquidity premium, that it's going to override a decline in commodities. We don't know yet, because right now commodities have been going straight higher, which makes sense in terms of rising break evens. So I think it's important to see what happens if we do start to see declines in some of these commodity prices, either from supply chains normalizing or demand falling, or both. But if we see, like, you know, copper keeps going up, the exchange rate of copper over $3. Hard to say that break even shouldn't be going up, at least in the short term, on a big rise in oil, copper, lumber, and things like that.
Right. And so, no, that's all interesting. And one could also argue, taking not the opposite view, but slightly counter view, is that, well, you know what? The only thing that matters is what the dollar does. Like, if the dollar whips higher or whips lower, and of course, there's many people that think both will happen, and they're all 100% sure they're right. It is really just the next move in the dollar, the thing that's going to pretty much either unwind those trades you mentioned or indeed reinforce them.
I think it's a critical factor. I think it's an absolutely critical factor. I would put myself, I'm not as into the foreign currency market as I am, perhaps bonds. But I wouldn't put myself into the dollar bear camp. I would lean more towards the long-term dollar bull camp. I understand why the dollar is probably going down in the short term. The way that I think about the dollar, the US dollar, is when global growth is improving, and we're talking about a rate of change here. So, if global growth was -4% and it moves to -1%, that's an improvement in global growth. Whenever we see improvements in global growth, the dollar tends to weaken.
Yeah.
And whenever we see declines in global growth, the dollar tends to strengthen. So as the global economy was falling apart, the dollar had a super spike. It's undeniable that global growth is improving from its worst point. So based on that framework, it makes sense that the dollar is going down. I mean, there's been some aggressive declines, which may be more than expected, but directionally that framework still plays out here. We have an improvement in global growth, an improvement in US growth, the dollar has been coming down. The real question here is, now we've had no real fiscal support for over a month now. We have this pent-up demand rebound that's been going on for a couple of months. If the pent-up demand rebound starts to fizzle out, commodity prices start to go down. If we have no fiscal support and consumers start to really slow down again, and we start to see a decline in U.S. growth again, sort of moving back towards a double dip recession, sort of. If we see that, I would expect the dollar to start rising again. So to me, I don't think the dollar is moving independently. I don't think it's moving because of the Fed. I don't think it's moving that much because of the ECB. I mean, these are all factors on the margin. I think the most critical factor for the dollar is the direction of the U.S. and global economy in rate of change terms. And we've had a massive improvement in global growth. Dollar's gone down. I think in the next couple of months here, we'll probably start to see that rate of improvement start to fizzle out. And I think that there's going to be a floor under the dollar as a result.
Right. And I think it's important because a question I get asked a lot is, basically, people get that investing is about probabilities. So, okay, if you want, you can be in the inflation or the deflation camp and you could put 100% of your portfolio on that. But you know what? You might be wrong. And if you're wrong, you're going to get a drawdown. So most people know it's probably good to hedge themselves in some way. And which side you want to invest more in is probably where you think there's higher probability. Now, this is a relatively simplistic way of looking at it. You can look into betas and other things to get more sophisticated. But the thing I always thought, like, the inflation hedges are pretty easy to kind of get your head around, right? I mean, gold, silver, tips, equities, commodities, these are kind of pretty simple things. But the deflation hedges, like, you could maybe argue that if things got really bad, you might want to own gold, but you're going to be battling against a higher real rate. So really, you're just nominal bonds, nominal US Absolutely. Dollar bonds and long US dollars. And this is not that exciting for many people.
It's really kind of
this little theory of like, well, the inflation trades are much more sexy and they're much cooler. And I'm slightly weighted in my portfolio towards slightly more kind of inflation based ones than deflation, but still a good portion of deflation ones, because I really just don't know. And I'm kind of deliberately not talking about, of course, you know, you could short things, but a lot of people are not comfortable doing that. So, you know, if you really want something that is going to pay out if the stock market goes down, you short it. Right. You have to worry about correlations to breaking down as they did.
Definitely. Definitely. And that's an important consideration. The correlations going to one, absolutely an important consideration.
One or
that
minus
tends to happen
one.
In these, you know, especially during these big, risk off events, like you just said in March, where every, there were days where pretty much every single asset you could possibly own was going down.
Correct. Yeah.
But you know, I'm glad you brought that up, and if you don't mind, I'll just sort of,
yeah, I'd love to hear you.
Just give you my thoughts for some of the listeners that may not be familiar with how I think about my portfolio management and things like that. So I run a service on Seeking Alpha where I publish a monthly portfolio of ETFs. And the starting framework is exactly as you just described. If you start from a position of, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if we're going to have inflation. I don't know if we're going to have deflation. I don't know if there's going to be a recession tomorrow. And I don't know if there's going to be a vaccine and we're off to the races tomorrow. Starting from that position of, I don't know, what's the portfolio that you want to have? And the baseline framework that I have is a take on Ray Dalio's All Weather portfolio. And the reason I start with that is because that portfolio, I mean, there's other portfolios that you can use. Chris Cole from Artemis Capital uses the Dragon portfolio, which is a little bit more complicated. But from a simplistic framework that basically anybody can replicate with a handful of ETFs, the best bet, in my opinion, is the all-weather portfolio, which has stocks, bonds, gold, and commodities. So we take that framework and we say, I have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. This is the portfolio that I'm going to have. Well, then we can take both our long-term research, sort of the secular trends, the 20, 30, 40-year trends, debt cycles, and sort of tilt the balance. If you say, okay, this portfolio is exactly even in terms of I have no idea what's going to happen, let me tilt the balance towards perhaps deflation. Then we can take our research view on the shorter term, you know, maybe the 12-month view, and tilt the portfolio again. And what we end up with is a portfolio that started totally balanced. And as you said, based on our research, you say, okay, well, I still don't exactly know. I can't be 100% sure. They can change the Federal Reserve Act tomorrow. I don't want to put 100% of my money into any one bet, deflation, inflation. I start from a balanced standpoint. I have a research view. That research view, in my opinion, tilts the probability towards one of these options. Therefore, I'm going to shift the balance of what was a balanced portfolio towards the assets that are going to benefit from the environment that's coming. So if you think deflation's coming, shift the balance more towards your nominal bonds. If you think inflation's coming, you can increase your commodity or gold exposure or add gold miners or inflation-linked equities or things like that. So that's sort of how I think about it. I think you explained my thought process pretty well in terms of it's all a probability. It's all a bet on what's more likely to happen. And the way that I look at the world is there's three paths forward from where we are now. We can do no fiscal support at all. We can say Congress can't agree to anything. There's going to be no more unemployment insurance. There's going to be no more one-time checks. Everyone's sort of on their own. Everyone's got to go back to paying rent. Everyone's got to go back to paying their mortgage. I don't think anybody argues from any camp that that would be very deflationary. I don't think we would go in that direction, although I'm not a political expert, so I can't really handicap what they're going to do in Washington. But if we let people default, or we just really have a lack of fiscal support, if fiscal spending goes back to pre-COVID levels with 11.5 million missing payrolls, there's going to be deflation. The option number two is we can sort of change the structure of the way the Federal Reserve operates. So right now, the Federal Reserve can't absorb any losses. So even when they're buying corporate bonds, the equity investment into the special purpose vehicles from the Treasury. So if any of those bonds default, all the losses accrue to the Treasury or the taxpayer. If we changed it to say, hey, if you got a bad asset that's about to default, the Fed can take it and poof, it goes away. That would sort of be more akin to literal printing money. I don't think anybody would argue that that would be crazy inflationary, because banks could sort of make loans willy-nilly. Anybody could have a loan. You could have a loan. And if it goes bad, I'll kick it to the Fed. That can't go on right now. That's not what's going on. But if we moved in that direction, very inflationary. The third option, which seems to be where everybody thinks we're going, and this is where the debate comes in, is the Fed or the Treasury is going to do massive fiscal stimulus. At some point, they're going to come to an agreement, whether it's the Trump administration or the Biden administration. They're going to come to some agreement and they're going to do massive fiscal spending. They're going to do more unemployment. They're going to do universal basic income. They're going to do more stimulus checks, more PPP, more everything. And is that inflationary or deflationary? The consensus, in my opinion, seems to think that radical fiscal spending would be inflationary. I think there's pretty sound evidence to suggest that it's more of the same. Even though the numbers are bigger, they sound scarier. It's more of the same as what we've been doing over the past 20 or 30 years. And there'd be a short-term stabilizing effect. But in the end, it wouldn't improve the real rate of growth in the economy. And it would actually continue to push us towards disinflation or deflation. So when I look at those three, I think there's two paths towards disinflation. There's one path towards major inflation. And therefore, my bias is still towards the deflationary camp, although I'm very, very cognizant of the things that can cause inflation, and I'm ready to shift if I see any of those things happen. But that's sort of how I view the current landscape and how I think about portfolio composition in that lens.
Yeah, and so I wanted to, that makes a lot of sense, and jump on the third point. So I think I'm right in saying that there was a paper about 10 years ago that looked at when government spending increases a bunch, actually this can lead to reductions in GDP, which is counterintuitive.
Absolutely.
And I can't remember.
Many papers. There's been.
Okay. But this isn't talked about much, because most 99, I'm assuming 99% of people would say, well, of course, if they spend more, it puts up GDP. I mean, government spending is part of the GDP calculation. I mean, well,
absolutely. But, you know, there's been many. I mean, the most popular one is by Reinhart and Rogoff, which says that, you know, when governments, when debt to GDP is over 50%, it starts to, you know, the positive effects start to diminish. And once you get over 90%, it actually starts to have a negative impact on growth. And we're going to be at 120, 130. The way that I like to describe this, if you don't mind, and you've talked to Dr. Lacey Hunt, I'm sure you've heard him say, we have the production function, right? And I'm not going to get all wonky like econometrics, but we have the production function. We have land, labor, and capital, right? And one of the things that Dr. Lacey Hunt says all the time is when you overuse one factor of production, you get diminished marginal returns. So the gains go up, they flatten out, and then they turn lower. That's a difficult concept to understand when we talk about capital, because it's not tangible. But let's think of the concept from the standpoint of labor, right? Let's see what happens if you overuse labor. If you use a hypothetical example, let's say you have an assembly line or you're washing a car, right? One person can wash a car maybe in 4 hours. Two people can wash a car in maybe 2 hours. So you cut the time in half. Three people can maybe wash a car in, you know, an hour and a half. Four people, five people, six people. At some point you reach a optimal level where you can't really wash the car any faster. Let's say it's six people. Six people, you get the best results. But let's say, what if we overused the labor component? Let's say we put 20 people or 40 people or 500 people. You'd start to wash the car a lot slower with 500 people than you would with six people. So that's the diminishing marginal returns concept. So when we overuse debt or overuse debt capital, it's the same kind of concept. There's an optimal level where you get the best bang for your buck, so to speak. And most of the papers are in the camp about 50% debt to GDP is kind of where it's optimal. Then you start to cross the threshold of where that curve starts to actually turn lower. And there's been a lot of research on this. Most of the research is about 90% debt to GDP. There's actually different thresholds for the government sector, the household sector, and the corporate business sector. But sticking with the government, about 90% debt to GDP is where that starts to turn negative, that curve. So now that we're at, you know, about 130%, that curve is going to start to get very negative, and it's nonlinear. So it's not going to go down, you know, in a straight line. It's going to start to go down, you know, more like a parabola exponentially. So if we go down the road of massive fiscal spending, and we take that debt to GDP ratio from 130 to 150 to 160 to 200, the evidence shows that that's going to have it's going to reduce real GDP per capita. It's not going to increase real GDP per capita. There's a lot of people right now are citing World War II and saying the government did massive fiscal spending and it got us out of World War II. I think there are a ton of extraordinary factors around World War II that made that situation happen. I don't think any of those things are happening right now. So I think it's a very different situation. We can talk about that. But to your point, the diminishing marginal returns concept is critical. A lot of people have a tough time grasping it when we just talk about overusing debt. But I think if you think about it from the example of like an assembly line, there's absolutely a level where you overuse one factor and it ends up giving you worse results, not better results.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So a bit of a slight tangent, but we haven't mentioned it yet, but I always like to get it in there. And I forgot to mention when you were talking through the kind of portfolio construction, how do you look at something like Bitcoin and all of that?
You know, I haven't researched Bitcoin very much at all, so it would be improper for me to comment on it. I've really done no work in the Bitcoin space.
Okay, that's
space
cool.
At all. I could understand, when you construct a balanced portfolio, there's room for all kinds of assets. I mean, I size everything according to volatility and things like that. So, you know, Bitcoin would probably be, if I were to include it in my portfolio, it'd probably be the most volatile asset, therefore probably getting the lowest weighting. I haven't done much work on the correlations. You know, people say it's uncorrelated to everything. I could get my head around the concept of a 0.5% or 1% allocation to it, but I really don't know much about it at all.
That's all right. Fair enough. So it's actually volatility right now is around 40. So it's actually lower than silver.
Well, there you go.
It's often relative. So you can think of it like a vol of like a gold miner. It's kind of like, yeah, kind of, but right. Sometimes it has spiked to hundreds.
Right.
And when Bitcoin has a vol spike, like, that does not mean the price has necessarily gone down. It could have actually gone up and caused.
It could have tripled.
It's very schizophrenic. Sometimes it moves, and you can tell because you can tell to the nearest second it moved when gold moved, and sometimes it does it when, say, tech stocks move. It doesn't really know what it is yet. So it overall, on a long period of time, it isn't that correlated with stuff, which is good.
Definitely.
But yeah, it's one of those things that. I always say to people, look, I mean, if you just don't care and, you know, and you just want something that's pretty uncorrelated, stick a small number of percent in your portfolio and forget about it. If you really want to go down the rabbit hole and, you know, someone like Raoul has really kind of got into it hugely, then that's fine too. But you know the risks. This is not like trading a 2-year bond.
That's right. Yeah. No, it's definitely something that I'll have to, I'll have to spend more time on. It's interesting. I mean, we see even the Fed, different papers out of the Fed talking about digital type currencies and stuff like that. So it's not like, a far-fetched concept. It's definitely there. I'd have to research more before I started making comments on it, but I could totally get behind a small allocation to the portfolio, as part of an otherwise balanced book. Totally makes sense.
All right. So why don't we finish with, we've talked about the election a little bit, but like as in your three things. So no fiscal at all, which I could argue is possible if after the election, no one controls all three parts.
True. Very true.
You know, I mean, we've all seen, and it doesn't matter who is, you know, whether it's the GOP keeping the Senate or the Dems keeping the House, like either is perfectly capable of digging their heels in for 2 years until the next elections. Number two is in effect change the Federal Reserve Act, well, that's perfectly plausible in certain scenarios. And number three, yeah, kind of, more, you know, more stimulus again. Again, that's quite plausible. So how are you thinking? Yeah, a lot of listeners are kind of thinking, well, wait a minute, like they've all seen the VIX structures and the VIX futures markets in contango, and there's gigantic volatility increases for November, way more than usual for an election. I mean, traditionally, election is a bit more volatile. And I mean, it's gone through my mind. It's like, well, let's just go 100% cash, see what happens.
Right.
I'm out the other side surviving. Mm-hmm. Or am I going to try and actually trade this? And I haven't made my mind up yet because I don't need to make my mind up yet. Right. But I'm just wondering, you know, when you're thinking through your kind of monthly thing on Seeking Alpha, like the election's, I mean, what, it's 6 weeks now? So
yeah, coming up for sure. Yeah, so the way that I think about it is the first thing is I always have the fallback of the balanced portfolio. So technically, if you're balanced to inflation, deflation, recession, or growth, you're going to have some asset that performs well regardless of the outcome, because we're going to have to fall into one of those buckets. Now, you could have a scenario for a short period of time where the correlation of all assets goes to one or negative one, and you know, everything goes down together. That is a risk. And you know, the way that you would hedge that, or you know, like Chris Cole with the Dragon portfolio, is you have like an options overlay with some convexity, which would account for a scenario like that. The options are priced, as you would expect, quite expensive. So the way that I would be inclined to prepare for something like that is probably to have just a higher cash position than normal. I probably wouldn't get too much into the volatility hedging because the price is so high. I'd probably go into it with slightly more cash than I normally do, and keep the framework of a balanced portfolio and just keep the tilt towards the long-term trend. So there's going to be volatility in the short run. I have no idea what's going to happen with the election, who's going to win, what the balance of power in Congress is going to be. We're going to get through it, and there's going to be probably a tremendous amount of volatility along the way. I'm willing to take that volatility. I'll probably boost my cash position to dampen some of that volatility. I'll have some assets that go down. I'll have some assets that probably go up. And then once we know the scenario, analyze, is any of this going to impact the long-term trends? Is any of this going to impact those three scenarios that we outlined? Does this tilt the balance towards inflation? Do we still stay with options one and three, which are more disinflationary? And I would say that to me, the probability stays with the disinflation or deflation route, regardless of who wins. Although I would say if I'm not making any political comments here, I would just say if Biden ends up winning with control of both chambers of Congress, I would say that would shift the balance slightly more towards the inflationary route. I'd say that it's a higher probability of changing the Federal Reserve Act. I think there are more proposals for that kind of policy coming on from that wing. But I don't think it's something that would happen immediately or overnight, because it's such a major change. I think there'd be pushback from a lot of parties, a lot of different people, a lot of different entities. So I think we would know if that proposal was on the table, but I don't think it's something that would, you know, we'd wake up one day and it would be enacted tomorrow. I think it would be impossible for it to move that quickly. So the way that I think about it is stay with a balanced framework, tilt in the direction that you think the long term is going in, sort of ignore the short term, and you could have a higher cash position, because there's going to be some asset that gets dislocated in the process. And if you have a higher cash position and you have a balanced book, you can scoop up that asset that probably would be in your portfolio anyway.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And I think that that's perfect advice for
And just to, and I'm sorry to cut you off. Just to contextualize, my viewpoint on my portfolio, my sweet spot is in the 12 to 36 month range. So that's sort of how I think about my portfolio and assets. I'm not I rebalance my portfolio on a monthly basis. I'm not trying to perform every single month. I'm not trying to be positive every month or even every quarter. So there's risks around the election, but I'm not saying, you know, I don't really have the answer for how do you come out of the election with a positive return. That to me is not the game that I play. I'm in the 12 to 36 month view, and trying to figure out, is the change in the president or Congress going to impact the 12 to 36 month view of the economy?
Right. And that was going to be my point, which was, I think if someone is, let's just in effect in spot markets, so someone that doesn't have a large options portfolio, then that long-term view is exactly what, well, medium to long-term view. You can write it out and you should go like that. It's more difficult for people that have, say, 5, 10, 15% in various option strategies, because of course, a lot of these are very time limited. For myself, I'm like maybe 6-7% of different options. Some of it's long volatility, some of it's just simply on things like gold, on treasuries. And actually, if I look at it, it's kind of fairly balanced. I'm trying to work out, do I pare some of those down before, just because they might go against me, but then at the same time, by definition, they're giving you long volatility exposure. If it really does go crazy in November, December, which is possible, I mean, this could be the mother of all arguments that makes 2000 that like child's play with the hanging chads.
That's right.
I mean, my friend, we were talking about before, fed up biz owner, his latest thinking is, it's 2020. So, that like Ruth Bader Ginsburg has to have an issue. And like, the day this all has to come to court or something, like, right. Something nuts has to happen. It is plausible by the 21st of January, we still don't know. And whatever happens, half of America is going to be pissed. So
that's right.
I
would just make one comment here, and I don't mean this to be political at all. It's sort of my long-term view of where things are headed. And it sort of ties into a lot of the things that you discussed in that podcast, the beginning of the podcast, which was more about the social unrest and the political environment. The way that I come at it is the most important single metric for anybody to look at for long term is real GDP per capita or real disposable income per capita, because that's the determinant of the standard of living. If real GDP per capita, if the growth rate is going up, then everyone's enjoying a rising standard of living. If it's going down, that's bad. Over the very, very long term, hundreds of years, real GDP per capita, real disposable income per capita has been about 2%. And that's long history. That's a good range because that's an average. So there are bands. There are people that are going up at 3 or 4%, and there are people that are going up at, 0.5% or 1%, and the country average is 2%. Because of a lot of the dynamics of debt and things that are going on and overusing the debt capital, getting worse results, we're starting to see that real GDP per capita come down. Now it's come down into the 1% range. And why is that a problem? Because of those bands that we talked about. That means that there are people that are going up at 2 and 3%, but now that also means that there are people that are showing a declining standard of living. The people at the lower end of that band, people are now going up at -1 or 0. And a declining standard of living is very, very problematic. And it's a justifiable reason for social unrest. It's very uncomfortable to have a declining standard of living. So what's going to happen here is, as we continue to go down the path of more debt, if that's the path that we choose, that real GDP per capita is going to continue to come down. And based on various metrics, we can estimate that we could sink into an environment here post-COVID of less than 1% GDP per capita, which means that there's going to be a significant and rising percentage of the population that's going to be having a declining standard of living. And that's probably going to increase the volatility of the political and social situation. And the longer it takes us to correct that path, the lower the real GDP per capita is going to go, and the more percentage of the population is going to be below zero. And that's ultimately the biggest problem facing the politicians now is that there's a growing share of people that are seeing a declining standard of living. It's very uncomfortable. And those people rightfully are demanding some sort of change, because we can't have a situation where real GDP per capita growth is, you know, let's say 0.8%. The wealth distribution is skewed to the top. So even though it's 0.8, we have 60 or 70% of people that are below zero, not really a sustainable situation. And that's my fear of where we're headed if we continue to go down the same road. So I'm not making a political comment about what we should do. I'm just saying, I believe that's what's going to happen. And I think that that's going to make the political and social situation stay pretty volatile.
Right. Yeah. And what you've just described is, it's just math, right?
Exactly.
I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think there's much debate that real GDP has been trending down more recently. And if it's at 1%, by definition, there's going to be winners and losers in any world we live in.
Exactly.
And there's going to be people negative, and that equals social unrest. I mean, I actually haven't heard it explained that succinctly, Paul. That was excellent. It's a bad thing, but it's like,
it sums up everything. It's very unfortunate, but it sort of contextualizes the world around us. And as you get closer to the zero bound, more of the people are below zero. And history shows us that if 50% or more of the people are extremely uncomfortable, that's a recipe for large change. And we're headed in that direction. And it's not just the United States. I mean, Japan is below zero. I mean, their trend growth is really bad, mostly due to their demographics. Europe is converging to zero pretty quickly. Yeah. So they're going to be in a similar situation. I think Brexit has a lot to do with that. I think that there's going to be issues in the periphery of Europe because of that. And the U.S. is going in the same direction, not too far behind. We're not quite at zero yet, but I believe that the risk here is that we slip below one in the next 3 to 5 years, which means that we're going to have probably more than 50% of the people that are going to be below zero. And that's going to create a pretty unstable situation.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, let's end it there. But how can people learn more about you, Eric? What are the...
You could find me on Twitter. I'm pretty active on Twitter at EPB Research. And I also write pretty frequently on Seeking Alpha. You can go to Seeking Alpha, type in my name, Eric Basmajan, or EPB Macro Research. They'll both pop right up. I write for free. I also have a premium service that I include the model portfolio. And I'm also going to be starting a YouTube channel where I'm going to explain some concepts like quantitative easing and things like that. So you could probably look out for that also.
Fantastic. That'll be awesome. All right. Good stuff. And we'd love to get you back on here sometime in the future. Let's see what's happening in a few months.
Absolutely. Anytime. I had a great
time. I'm sure nothing will have changed. So
yeah, unfortunately.
Nothing will have changed except everything will have changed. So
yeah, that's right.
All righty. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thanks so much.